Coming up on Tech Nation, SC Mawati uses her background at such familiar companies as Facebook, Trulia, and Nokia to bring us Mobilized, an insider's guide to the business and future of connected technology. Then on Biotech Nation, how much should we know about the clinical trials behind the drugs approved by the FDA? Jennifer Miller is the founder and president of Bioethics International and a professor at NYU Medical School. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Ever since I was a kid and developed a keen interest in my brother's Boy Scout manual and its how-to on earning merit badges, I've been into how-tos. My current favorite is How to Build an Island, brought to you by China. Oh, they're not the only folks to build an artificial island or two, but they certainly have stepped it up to a whole new level. If you look on your map, you'll see that as big as China is, it has only a modest shoreline on the South China Sea. While the South China Sea has more significant borders with Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and others. Surely it must sting to see the resources that go with that great body of water and its strategic location outside of your control, all the while enjoying the benefits of your name. Instead of requesting a name change, China has gone deep into the South China Sea, some 600 miles from its southernmost dirt, Hainan Island, and built a set of artificial islands. Thanks to modern technology, this is a very simple how-to. In a three-step process, you first locate a naturally occurring base structure, like a barely submerged rock formation or a coral reef. Then bring in the old dredging barges, the ones that scrape sand, rock, whatever, from the seafloor and chop it up into pieces. And then critically, step three, aim the whole thing at your base structure. Now it's best to have a plan. Do you just want a big hill? Or would you like a long and narrow spit of dirt, say 10,000 feet long, so you could, say, land a military jet? With the technology portion of this commentary completed, let the politics begin. And that includes the national interests of any number of nations, and not just those on the South China Sea. For perspective, let's say your neighbor Fred decided to do some dry land dredging of his own and thought that a landscaped hill in the corner of his yard would be nice. Only the height of this hill is well over your head, and the corner of his yard is immediately on the other side of the fence from your picnic table. You speak nicely with Fred about it, and Fred says, "Hey, this is my backyard. And by the way, don't fly over my hill either." This is not unlike what's been going on with these Nuevo Islands, some a mere 100 miles from the Philippines. China claims it has the right to build these islands under something called the 9-Dash Lines, previously known as the 11-Dash Lines, and once asserted to be 10-Dash Lines, but that doesn't matter. China is building air bases on what has now grown to a collective 2,000 acres of landfill and has asserted full territorial rights. The U.S. did some freedom of navigation patrols and was told so definitively, as were any number of fishing boats. Sometime back, the Philippines filed a claim with the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, which is also binding on China, having signed an international treaty. The result is in, and the dash lines are out. China has no legal basis to claim sovereignty. And then there's that nasty business of all that environmental damage. China is rejecting this decision out of hand, and who knows where it will go from here, except there'll be a fight. So let's not forget the biggest Boy Scout how-to of them all. Be prepared. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, S.C. Mowatty tells us about Mobilized, an insider's guide to the business and future of connected technology. Then on Biotech Nation, Jennifer Miller, the founder and president of Bioethics International. How much do we know about the clinical trials, which are the basis for FDA drug approval? S.C. Mowatty runs the forum Products That Count. She tells us that people are spending more time on their mobile devices than they are on their computers. So, hey, S.C., what's up with that?
It started 10 years ago, but it really happened just a couple of years ago that we spend more time using our smartphones than behind a computer. And what's really interesting about that is that this is one of the few technology trends that started with us people as opposed to businesses. If you think about the computers, they started with big business who made use of computers for accounting purposes and operations purposes. Not so with mobile. With mobile, what happened is everybody started to have a smartphone, use it for our own personal use, and then we brought it to work, right? And that created a trend called bring your own device. And then companies started to realize that everybody was using their smartphones, and the marketing departments in particular started saying, well, if I want to stay relevant, I better reach these people on their smartphones. And so they turned to their organizations and said, we need to become mobile. And now every business that I talk with wants to become what they call mobile first, but they don't really know what it means.
So you wrote a book.
So I wrote a book about it.
That works. You know, it's funny. This has crept into my consciousness for the last, say, 4 or 5 years. I had a graduate student who worked at Genentech, and I said, what are you doing? And he goes, well, basically, you know, I write a lot of apps for everybody, you know, and it's not just marketing. And I realized, holy moly, you are revamping the organization on people's personal cell phones. You know, in the meantime, then we've had all of these social media or sharing economy apps come along more and more on your smartphone. How deeply are smartphones penetrating in the United States?
Oh, the penetration of smartphone is over 70% right now. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, it represents about 4% of the gross domestic product in most countries, according to the Boston Consulting Group. In countries like South Korea, it's 11% of GDP, the gross domestic product. So it is a real huge transformation of our economy. And the interesting part about it is that it's not just like, you know, most other utilities about public programs like railroad or electricity. It's all about private money. The companies that are benefiting the most from mobile are companies, businesses, as opposed to government. And naturally, that means that every company wants to take a part of it and really should get a meaningful piece of mobile.
I think what's so funny as well is that, as you're saying, you know, people picked up mobile phones and they stayed there. They say, okay, this is mine and I'm going to keep using it wherever I'm going. What is really happening is that all of these people everywhere are developing apps. Anybody can develop an app. And it's got just as good a shot as getting on somebody's smartphone as anybody else's. So what's on your smartphone is this conglomeration of what the manufacturer put on and whatever deals they made, but then things that you've downloaded that are individualized. Big business have their front ends there. There's not a relationship I don't have on the internet that hasn't come around saying, don't you want to download our app? It's like, I don't know how much screen space I have to keep looking through to see where anything is. I mean, it is really a melting pot of apps on anybody's smartphone.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, right now, there is a bit of a bidding war to get attention from people on their mobile phones, because large companies are able to spend hundreds of millions of dollars marketing their services, and then small developers are able to come up with something completely innovative and capture the heart and mind of people. And the real challenge is that with this transformation, it's a matter of survival, right? Like, businesses are saying more people are using mobile than computers. So if I don't reach my customers on mobile, I'm no longer going to be in business. And the challenge is that this mobile revolution is happening so fast that within 2-3 years, you can be out of business. That happened with a number of companies. Take the example of Kodak, for example. Kodak didn't, you know, catch on time the trend that people are going to take pictures on their phones as opposed to carrying cameras around. They thought that print would never go away, whereas if you think about where you have your photo right now, they're all on your phones. They're no longer on your photo albums.
With Kodak, I mean, it's sort of like it was game over in just a matter of a few months. It was amazing how fast that happened. But being able to get out there in front of what's happening, imagining where things are going now, that's a challenge for everybody today. You just can't have a Me Too app.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, a company like Facebook, where I worked for some time, almost missed that mobile transition. And what happened at Facebook is that it took the mobile revolution as a technology problem. And so it trained all of its engineers into the programming languages of mobile and said, okay, we're done. And that didn't work. In fact, the stock went from $40 to $20. So Facebook, we sat down and looked at, you know, what we needed to do, because everybody was looking at mobile and saying, Facebook is going to die if it doesn't get mobile. You may remember some of these articles. So one of the core value, for example, that Facebook had to change in order to become mobile is move fast and break things. It was in the DNA of the company. But if you break things on mobile, what happens? It's very different than what happens on the web. Like, imagine you're using a broken app yourself. What will happen is you will get frustrated. Maybe you will leave a bad review. Maybe you'll stop using the app and then you will delete it. And then there's no more Facebook on your phone, right? So Facebook had to change that mindset from move fast and break things to just move fast. No more breaking things. And that's the tip of the iceberg of the really deep cultural shift that the company had to undertake in order to become mobile. And that's what I tell today to most of the businesses that want to succeed with the mobile transition. It's not about technology. It's about changing your culture.
Now, what's the difference between designing an interface for a mobile device versus a website?
Yes, this is such an interesting question, because you can take a look at it from so many different perspectives. The way I look at it is mobile products are extensions of ourselves. And so we need to think about the best mobile product as our best selves. And I use the mind, body, spirit example or framework to describe what that is, right? So look at the body. Like, we all want to look good. I want to look good. Well, our mobile products need to look good if they're going to be successful. We also want to have meaningful lives. Our mobile products need to give us meaning. And then we want to keep learning and growing as people. And the best mobile products also need to learn and grow with us.
So give us some examples. I mean, you talk about, for instance, the mom test. What's the mom test and where does it fit into your formula?
Right, right. The mom test is one of my favorite tests. When I tell my mom what I do, most of the time she'll nod and she'll say, that sounds great. She doesn't really get it.
That's
but
fine.
Then,
that's great.
Exactly. As long as you're having
fun.
I'm so
proud of you.
Exactly. But then there are these moments where all of a sudden she understands what I'm doing. And there's this reaction that she has, which is, oh, yes, I get it, right? And that is the mom test. So if you have a service, a mobile product that you want to be successful, you want it to pass that mom test. You want to show it to somebody who is not familiar with it. You want to, in a few seconds, have that visceral reaction that, yes, they got it. And to me, this is a very important test to show that this product is beautiful in an emotional way. And the reason I bring that up is because here in Silicon Valley, we're so often, you know, we're engineers, we're so often like focused on the rational, the efficiency, but there are so many different components to what makes a mobile product beautiful. And of course, there is this rational, efficient element, but there is also that emotional element. And to me, that is what the MOM test is.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is S.C. Mowatty. With a career background at such familiar companies as Facebook, Trulia, and Nokia, her experience in mobile products was influenced by her master's in electrical engineering and her Stanford MBA. She currently runs Products That Count, a forum for product makers and innovators, and she's here today with Mobilized, an insider's guide to the business and future of connected technology. Well, it seems for a few years now, everybody's been talking about the Internet of Things. Where are all these mobile devices in the things?
Right. That's a great question. Today, we look at mobile primarily through our smartphones. And if you think about smartphones, they're actually a very clunky device, right? This big rectangle that fits or sometimes doesn't fit in our hand. The Internet of Things is a more sophisticated version of mobile products. It can be a wristband, a pair of glasses, earrings. It can be a pill. It can be a piece of clothes. And that's like bringing mobile closer to you. Or it can be a smart car, a smart city when you explode that smartphone into your environment. When you look at the statistics today, most of us have one personal device, which is our smartphone. The Internet of Things says in about 5 years, we'll have five of these personal devices. It will take many different forms, but that's a statistic that the investment firm Goldman Sachs has put out.
Well, they're certainly going to make sure we all buy that many. So,
absolutely. And think for a moment of the power of the Internet of Things. I'll give you a couple of examples. I had a chance just a few weeks ago to try the new Facebook product, the Oculus headgear. And all of a sudden, I was transported in a Syrian refugee camp. And I followed the day of a little girl from the moment that she has her breakfast to going to school, to the computer lab, to then having food in this very, you know, communal environment. And it really like opened my eyes and melted my heart to, you know, the experience of that little girl. I think that these mobile devices and the promise of mobile and the Internet of Things is just that it's going to make us more empathetic to others that live in such different environment. But mobile products are going to allow us to be transported into these environments.
Just as the very first, you know, personal phones were big, clunky, weighed 5 pounds. They were horrible. They're a long distance from what a smartphone is today. So all of this technology is going to keep evolving.
It is. And a glimpse at the future that I love is happening right now in Montreal. I was there a few months ago, and they are conducting a number of experiments to bring mobile to the scale of a city. So one example, they are pushing offers to commuters who take public transportation. They partnered with a number of merchants and pushing offers for, you know, buy one, get one free, or free lunch for, you know. These offers are being converted 5 to 8 times better than just regular offers, just because they are linked to a mobile phone when people are at the right time, at the right place, coming out of public transportation. And then they combine that with a program that is helping build communities around the environment. They're saying, if you take public transportation rather than driving into the city, you will save one tree in terms of the energy that is being consumed by, you know, your car driving in and out of the city. So every time you take public transportation, we'll make you win at this game of saving tree. You will save a tree. And it was fantastic to observe how it created a whole community in the city of people who are conscious of, you know, their environment and want to be a part of that.
We've had repeated scientific studies about how humans always anthropomorphize objects. They make them human. But the smartphone is more. I mean, we keep saying we hold it in our hand. It's almost literally an extension of our bodies.
That's absolutely right. Phones are extensions of ourselves and mobile product in general. Today, smartphones are very clunky extensions of ourselves. But if you look beyond that, these products are already going to be, you know, changing and becoming closer to us. Like, think about a wristband. I was talking to a research group at Berkeley the other day. They are coming up with tattoos that are smart tattoos, right? So instead of having a smartphone, you're going to have a smart tattoo. That's a temporary one, of course, but that will give you all the benefit of your smartphone. Now, when you think of the best mobile product, people often ask me that question. So how do you know what makes for a great mobile product? I tell them, well, how do you know when you're at your best, right? And so the mind-body-spirit framework is one of the best ways to explain like how we become our best selves. Same thing with mobile products. If you look at, you know, the body of mobile product, they have to be beautiful, because if we are at our best self, we want to be beautiful. The spirit of mobile product, they need to give us meaning. Like, we all want meaningful lives, and we expect our mobile products to give us meaning. And then the mind, we all, when we are at our best selves, want to keep learning and growing. And our mobile product need to do just that. They need to learn and grow with us.
You know, I was thinking about what you were writing about meaning. And it's one thing to say, well, I want to, you know, answer the phone, or I want to find out where the nearest pizza place is or whatever. But whenever I think about people, they say, oh, let me show you my son or my grandson or when we just got back from this, and they pick up their phone. The meaning is within the phone.
That's right. And it all comes to, you know, how is your phone able to bring your context, the things that matter to you, and make it closer to you and more relevant? I'll give you an example. I love using Uber, the ride-sharing service. And what I love about it is that, first of all, it uses my location, right? It knows exactly where I am. It gets me places without me having to find the direction, navigate, without me even having to pay. How's that for personalization?
Well, you pay, but it's on the credit card.
And it's on the cloud.
But you don't have to give it to. It's all out there. It's all been set up.
That's right. So it's an experience that's highly personalized. And this is an example of a transportation service. But if I look at, you know, dating services like Tinder, for example, Tinder is a fabulous service because it's so personalized. It shows me people who are open to meeting new people near me at the right time. I can choose. It has a double opt-in mechanism. So if I don't want to meet somebody, they will never know where I am. And it's just wonderfully personalized to my mood, my context, my environment. Now, when I project that, there's a bit of love, right? Like, I think we fall in love with our mobile products. And I think that's perfectly fine. It's the ultimate
form
of meaning.
There were some robotic systems I was really crazy about. So it's got to be possible.
Exactly.
Now, let's talk about some mobile devices that kind of went wrong. Let's start with Google Glass. Remind everybody how it worked and what it was and what was right about it and what was wrong about it.
Yes. So Google Glass is a very interesting example of a mobile product because, you know, we were talking about that personalization and meaning that we find in our mobile product. Google Glass was built to do just that. It was built to tell you information about your environment through these glasses without you even having to research that information yourself. So it's, in a way, the ultimate form of personalization, and that's really, really meaningful. But then on the other hand, people started to feel uncomfortable with Google Glass. Like, for example, you know, was it on or was it off? There was no clear signal about it.
Are they recording me?
Were they recording or were they not? Were they meant to help me or were they meant to help Google collect more information about the world? And all of a sudden, that, you know, escalated into Google Glass being banned from some restaurants, some bars. Even some governments started to take restrictions on the use of Google Glass. And the product, because it was so early and so and had trouble communicating its value, was taken out of the market. Now, don't get me wrong. I do think Google Glass is a very interesting product, maybe not ready for, you know, a use case with people like you and I, but maybe more ready for applications in professional environments. Like right now, there are some experiments with doctors and surgeons to see if there is value in the use of a product like Google Glass.
Yeah, so sometimes we need to find what the right app is, the right situation is, and other times we just need everybody to get more accustomed to what's going on and to have, as you say, signals that it's recording or not recording, or any number of things that are just tweaks in the design that settle things down.
That's right. And that's part of, you know, what I call the mind rule, this idea that our mobile products need to keep learning with us and for us. I'll give you an example. WhatsApp, the mobile messaging service, which has completely replaced SMS in many places. So when you send a message on WhatsApp, it will show you like two little check marks to let you know that the message has been delivered. And then when you read my message, the check marks will turn a different color. Now, you may wonder, like, why is WhatsApp showing me these two pieces of information? And the answer is WhatsApp is learning constantly what we value in our communication. So it decided, it tested and iterated many, many times. And then it decided that these were the two pieces of information that would enhance your experience and would make you feel comfortable that you had a good communication with your partners who are also using WhatsApp.
So it's like, yes, it got sent. Because sometimes you go out there 2 hours later and you say, oh, it didn't get sent, which is very, very disappointing. And then they picked it up.
That's right. That's right. And if you think about, you know, the alternative before WhatsApp, SMS, in many cases, if you sent a message to someone and they used a different carrier, the message would arrive hours later, or sometimes it would never arrive. And then the message would, you know, not necessarily be responded on time just because of these delays to going from one carrier to the next. So WhatsApp really fixed that communication glitch.
I'm speaking with S.C. Mawati, the author of Mobilized, An Insider's Guide to the Business and Future of Connected Technology. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, how transparent are drug trials? We'll hear from Jennifer Miller, the founder and president of Bioethics International. Stay with us. Listening to Tech Nation, I'm speaking with S.C. Mawati, the author of Mobilized, An Insider's Guide to the Business and Future of Connected Technology. Now, let's talk about a voice app that I just wasn't big on, and some people like, and it's called Siri, S-I-R-I. We've seen ads on television about it and stuff. Remind us of Siri and what's good and bad about it.
Mm-hmm. Siri is a personal assistant, if you want. And what's fascinating about Siri is that it was created to be what the founder called a do engine, something that would do things for you as opposed to just search for things for you. Now, Siri was also a little bit ahead of its time, and people started to try and find flaws with Siri. They would ask them like silly questions and see what kind of answers they would get. And Siri really never took off as a do engine. Today, the way most people use it is to set a reminder on their calendar or to program an alarm. Kids use it because it has a lot of Easter eggs, and so they look for, you know, kind of funny things that Siri might do. But I think the promise of Siri is not unlike what we see in the movie Her, where you have this personal assistant that understands you and personalizes everything to you and does things for you that you wouldn't be able to do yourself or you wouldn't have time to do yourself.
One of the things I found interesting about your book is looking at the evolution of how people who develop these apps learn. And I mean, a great example is Tinder, which is simply, you know, saying, okay, you're shown a series of pictures and goes to the right if you like the person, to the left if you don't. It seems very simple. But they went through a lot of evolution on how it would work. Just learning how people could use it, would use it, upsides, downsides. Let's go there as an example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tinder is a fantastic service. It's a dating service that will show you
which is highly shallow because it's just on looks. But that's what we're talking about.
It can be shallow, although I have to say I met my fiancé on Tinder.
There's an endorsement.
So I'm grateful for the service. So Tinder is a very interesting service because what it does is it shows you people who are nearby and willing to meet people. And you can choose whether you're going to meet them or not. And that's the swipe right and swipe left. Now, what's fabulous about Tinder is that it really replicates the environment that we're in, let's say in a bar or at a conference or even at work, right? We see somebody, we find them good looking, we find them interesting, we're attracted to them in some way, and we'd like to talk to them. So what do we do in real life? Well, we, you know, look at them, give them maybe a double take. Maybe we walk up to them.
I'm learning some stuff here. I'm just like, well, that never happened. But I wouldn't have to do that with Tinder, huh?
You wouldn't have to do that with Tinder. It saves you the embarrassment of, you know, rejection because it's a double opt-in mechanism. Both partners have to say, yes, I'm interested before they actually get introduced. So it's a safer way to meet people online.
In your book, you described how it had to learn how to do these things just in the 4 years it's been in business.
Yes, you're right. Tinder had to go through a number of iterations before it got to the product that it is today. Let me give you a couple of examples. The hallmark of Tinder, what really got it on the map, was that swipe right, swipe left gesture. Now, people started to ask for more. And so Tinder introduced lists so you could save the number of people you were interested in who were, say, in San Francisco or in Los Angeles or in New York, depending on your travel schedule. And that had some success. So Tinder decided that maybe you could, you know, charge money for this. And then Tinder came up with another way that it could, you know, learn from its users. It said, well, you know, people who are younger are willing to experiment a lot more than people who are older. People who are older maybe want to settle into more serious relationships. And so we're going to offer different types of services depending on how old people are. Another thing that Tinder tried to do was to give you a second chance. I love that, right? Like you get a second chance in life. So if you saw somebody that you really liked, but then they didn't choose to interact with you, well, maybe they will get a second look at you. And Tinder is offering some ways that you can do that. So through all that trial and error, right, some of these experiments were successful and some of these weren't. And Tinder is learning to adapt to behaviors in a very systematic way.
I think the big takeaway for me is to expect to work with the people who use all this, that you got to think of new things and new ways. And what it's not like, we designed it and implemented it last year. We don't expect to. We have a 5-year plan. 5 years is like 2 centuries in this mobile environment.
That's right. Things keep changing and they change at such a rapid pace. I'll give you an example. When I worked at Facebook, one of the products that I was responsible for is the push notifications. And today...
That's you? You're under arrest. Social media arrest.
that would have been true
For
version number one.
Push.
Because people were not very familiar with what push notifications were. And then if you saw on your phone, like how they were described as sounds, badges, and alerts that you may be receiving. And that sounds really off-putting.
And it's pushing things to you.
That is right, yes. And so most people said, there's no way I want to receive these push notifications. But the benefit of receiving push notifications is that when a friend of yours sends you a message, you know about it immediately. When a friend of yours has a birthday, you can wish him happy birthday and it pops on their phone. Or when someone tags you in a picture, you want to make sure you look good on that picture as soon as it's posted, right? So these push notifications were were a way to help you be more in control of your experience. And once people realize that, and now it is a lot more accepted, once people realize that, all of a sudden their behavior started to change towards push notifications. Now, the phenomenal thing is that didn't happen over the span of like 3 or 4 years. Like you said, it happened in less than 6 months. And that's because behavior on mobile change at such a rapid pace.
Well, the expectations, the demands, the response of people on mobile, they're uncontrollable. I mean, there's no police on this. You have to look. You have to actually look at how they're using what they're saying. You have to kind of read the tea leaves of what's going on with your situation.
Yes, that's absolutely right. In fact, I think this is one of the areas where there's going to be the most innovation on mobile in the next few months or few years, because we do not have right now social norms or rules to use our mobile products when we're in our communities. And that, I think, is really important. In my book, I talk about a number of what I call personalization and community filters that can help mobile companies achieve that. For example, you mentioned permissions, like I'm giving you permission to tag me, or policies like I want, you know, my profile or some information about me to be hidden through privacy policies. Or another filter that I talk about is reviews and ratings, which build trust on, you know, between you and I, like, oh yes, like I would like to interact with that person because she has been endorsed by a number of my friends.
So it's what your friends say. Your friends make the decision.
That, I think, is a big factor on mobile, because it's bringing us closer to context, not just context as in the people and the places that matter to us.
Well, one last question on the tyranny of crowds here. We know what happens when you're on Yelp or Angie's List or something like that and you're getting positive reviews. How bad is it if you're a small business and you start getting negative reviews? Is that bad?
Reviews carry a huge weight for businesses. In fact, the Harvard Business Review did a study that shows that one star on Yelp can improve, like if you improve your rating by one star on Yelp, it can drive your sales by up to 8%. And I was talking to a few business owners who have really flourishing reviews on Yelp and asking them what their biggest fear was. Their biggest fear is getting bad reviews, not necessarily from their customers, but from their competitors who are trying to blackmail them in a way and impact their business.
Ooh, I guess that's possible, isn't it?
It's possible, although it's something that Yelp is very aware of. In fact, they have a huge team in the background that reviews the review that people leave on businesses to make sure that this doesn't happen.
They kind of try to smell it out.
That's right.
See if it's for real. Well, Sophie Charlotte, when did you transition from Sophie Charlotte to simply SC? Which I think is a great name, SC.
Thank you. I've always been called SC at work and Sophie Charlotte at home. And when I wrote Mobilized, my publisher came to me and asked me with a bit of hesitation, so what do you want your author name to be? And I say, I think I'm going to go with SC. And immediately they jumped in and said, what a fantastic idea, because Sophie Charlotte is so hard to pronounce.
Yeah, and that's a real author name, too. E.E. Cummings.
That's right.
S.C. Moati. Yes, I think you're right. You're right in there. S.C., so glad to speak with you. Please come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
I will. Thank you very much for having me.
My guest today is S.C. Moati. Her book is Mobilized, An Insider's Guide to the Business and Future of Connected Technology. It's published by Barrett Kohler. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, how much does the consumer know about the clinical trials which test a drug approved by the FDA? Jennifer Miller is the founder and president of Bioethics International and a professor at NYU Medical School. Jennifer, welcome back to Biotech Nation.
Thank you, Maura. It's great to be here.
Now, refresh us on the first Good Pharma scorecard. What did we talk about then back in 2012, and what's happened since then? So let's start with where you were.
Sure. So the Good Pharma scorecard evaluates all of the new medicines that the FDA approves on their clinical trial transparency. So basically, it takes all the new drugs to see if their clinical trials, the clinical trials that are included in the NDA, are registered, have summary results reported in the clinical trial registry, and are published in the medical literature. And so for our pilot rankings, we evaluated all of the drugs that the FDA approved in 2012 that were sponsored by large pharmaceutical companies. So in 2012, the FDA approved roughly 48 new molecular entities or novel therapeutics. And we looked at 15 of those 48 entities. Those were the drugs that were sponsored by the 20 largest pharmaceutical companies. So in 2012, that was any company with a market cap of over $18 billion. So we looked at 15 drugs sponsored by 10 companies, which involved 342 clinical trials with 100,000 people around the world. And what we found was a wide variety of transparency practices by drug and company. So some companies were 100% transparent. That means they disclosed all of the clinical trial results conducted to gain regulatory approval of their drug. So GSK and J&J were our top scorers. GSK disclosed 100% of its clinical trial results for its meningitis vaccine for children, and J&J disclosed 100% of its clinical trial results for its TB drug. And then there were a lot of companies and drugs that scored in the middle, and we had some low scores. So unfortunately, in our 2012 rankings, Gilead's HIV medicine, Stribald, didn't score very well. It only disclosed 21% of its clinical trials conducted to gain regulatory approval of its drug.
So what is it we can learn as the public looking at the results of clinical trials? Why are we interested in that?
So clinical trials contain all of the safety and efficacy information about new drugs. And so you need all of the safety and efficacy information in the public space for several reasons. One of them is that we want physicians to be able to prescribe the right drugs for the right patients at the right times. And in order to do that, they need all of the medical evidence. Often, physicians prescribe drugs based on prescription guidelines, and those prescription guidelines are based on a review of the public evidence. So if the public evidence is partial or compromised, we run the risk of having partial or compromised prescription guidelines. But moreover, have you ever wondered why it's okay to experiment on humans in healthcare innovation? Why do we allow humans to be exposed to risks in drug development. The reason is because it has the potential to contribute to generalizable knowledge. And so if clinical trial information is not put into the public space, arguably it's not contributing to generalizable knowledge, and it wasn't okay to experiment on those humans. And in fact, one of the number one reasons that people participate in clinical trials is altruism. They want to contribute to generalizable knowledge. So in order to make sure that we continue to involve people in clinical trials, we have to make sure that the results are publicly disclosed.
You know, there's another thing that goes on here for me. When you take that clinical trials data, if you never see it, and it gets translated to that little piece of paper that folds out with all the really tiny writing on it, and we're supposed to kind of figure out, is this right for me or not? It's a step that's a potentially very dangerous step.
That's right. In order to advance not only evidence-based medicine, but also innovation in general, you need all the clinical trial information in the public space. I was talking to some of the biotech founders yesterday at the biotech bootcamp, and one of them mentioned to me, you know, what you didn't say is that we need all of the clinical trial information in the public domain to save money. And I asked him, what do you mean? And he said, well, a lot of times we run clinical trials on molecules that have been already tested or similar molecules have already been tested. And he said, if I had known that the clinical trial had taken place, I wouldn't have wasted my money pursuing a dead end, right? And so since there are limited amounts of resources, we need to be as conservative and efficient as we can in developing the cures that people need.
Now, are there legal requirements to disclose any of this?
There are some legal requirements, some transparency requirements. So one of the reasons, so something you might want to ask about this data is, why are there some low scores? Why are some companies not that transparent? And part of the answer is that they're not legally required to. There is a law that governs clinical trial transparency. It's called FDA, and it was passed in 2007. And so one of the first things I did when I launched the Good Pharma Scorecard was that I set about to measure the scope of the law, and no one had ever done that before. So what I found is that FDA, the law, covers only 17 to 24% of the clinical trials conducted to gain regulatory approval of a drug. So arguably, it's a very narrow law. And so notwithstanding the narrowness of the law, there's still a high degree of noncompliance. The second part of the scorecard ranks companies with their compliance with FDA.
Is that more recent?
That's more recent, yes.
That's more recent.
And what we found is that there's an equal number of companies that are 0% compliant with the law as 100% compliant with the law. So very few companies score in the middle. Either they fully comply with the law or they don't. And
it's a one or zero deal.
There are five companies that were 0% compliant with FDA.
You know, it's really funny. I'm just sitting there with this vision of, here's Jennifer sitting in her office on her laptop going, hey, look, these companies are doing something illegal by not doing something. It's like, aren't you a little afraid they'll show up at your door and say, wait a minute.
No, so we work with all of the companies because one of the questions that you're raising is, why is there 0% compliance with the law? And so we spend a lot of time trying to figure out the narratives behind the numbers. And something that we've discovered is that there's a spectrum of interpretations of the law that have emerged. So different interpretations, so different companies interpret the law differently. And so the follow-up question to that is, are these reasonable interpretations, right? And some of them, in my opinion, are, and some of them are less convincing. That's right. Thank you. But some companies, and even some of us who evaluate compliance with the law, weren't sure whether the law applied to control trials or interventional trials.
Now, tell people the difference between the two.
Well, actually, that's part of the debate. What is the difference between a control trial and interventional trial? Interventional trials are trials that are done in patients, right? It's not healthy volunteers. That's one of the main distinctions. So I actually evaluated companies using the two different definitions, applying it to only control trials and then applying it to interventional trials, and the scores don't really change. So that is not what's driving noncompliance. I think, if anything, there's some confusion around the role of certificate of delays. So basically, the law says you have to disclose clinical trial information, clinical trial results, within a year of the primary completion date of the trial, so within a year of the trial being over. unless you file a certificate of delay, which I will tell you most companies do. And the certificate of delay says, well, then you can delay your results reporting until 30 days post-approval of the drug or 3 years post the filing of the certificate.
So it's 3 years for sure you're not going to see it.
Right.
And if your drug doesn't get approved.
That's exactly right. So what we found is that if clinical trial results were disclosed, they were often, most often, disclosed 30 days post-approval.
Now, I know that twice a year you call all the drug companies together and they come and meet with you, and they all come and meet with you.
We have been, I think the word is fortunate, to have a high degree of participation from companies. We send companies, every single ranked company, a copy of their data before we publicly disclose information. Every piece of data is gathered by two different independent scientists that are blinded to each other's work, and then it's validated. And then the third validation step is to send all the data to the companies and allow them to respond to the data. And we have, for the 2012 drugs, we had a 100% response rate from the companies. And in addition, we gather all of the companies together twice a year for 3 to 6 hours at a time, and we've been doing this since November of 2009, to understand a couple things. One, the narratives behind the numbers. You know, why are high scorers scoring well, and what are the challenges that the low scorers are experiencing? And two, we learn what are the best practices that the high-scoring companies have implemented, and how can the low-scoring companies adopt them and improve their practices over time in a way that's visible and demonstrated?
Now, you're collecting your data from what you're able to observe and collect, you know, which is the whole point. You know, can we find the data or can't we find the data? In dealing with the companies, surely you must have learned something about your data collection methods. Did they change in talking with the companies? Or is it more that the companies are changing what they permit people to see?
Our metrics and our data gathering methods were solidified while I was at Harvard. And I spent 4 years setting those standards and making sure the measurement instrument was fair and accurate, reliable, and consistent. So something that we may be changing for the 2014 and 2015 rankings and scorecard is our time frame of measurement. The 2012 rankings measured clinical trial transparency at 13 months post-approval of the drug. So that means that every company had at least a year or over a year to put their clinical trial information into the public space. And now we're thinking about adding two more measurements to the system at 6 months post-approval and 3 months post-approval. And one of those reasons is that a lot of formularies, that means for insurance companies or other types of payers or hospitals, make their formulary decisions around 3 months post-approval. And one of those is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They often encourage decisions to be made at 3 months post-approval.
You know, in your most recent reports, how did the industry score in total? What does it look like?
So we found a couple of things. One, we found that a median of around 20 clinical trials are conducted to gain regulatory approval of each indication. Sometimes it's less, particularly for rare diseases, and sometimes it's more. We also found that that number is going up. So you'll find that there are more trials being conducted to gain regulatory approval of drugs over the years, which is very interesting. Now, of those trials, we found that a median of 57% of clinical trials are registered 13 months post-approval of the drug, and that only 20% have results reported in a clinical trial registry like clinicaltrials.gov, which is run by the U.S. NIH. And we found that 56% of clinical trials per drug are published in the medical literature. And in total, about 65% of clinical trials per drug are publicly available. That means either reported in a registry or published in the medical literature. So two-thirds are available and about one-third of clinical trials per drug are not.
And you keep talking about post-approval. What about all the trials that just don't work or they fall out? What happens then?
Yeah, so because we can see the exact date that clinical trial information is put into the public space, so the exact date it's published or the exact date it's reported in an NIH registry, I can tell you that most clinical trial information is available post-approval. So if the drug isn't approved, much less likely that those clinical trial results will ever see the light of day.
But if you wanted to go straight to look at any particular clinical trial, if you went through your medicine cabinet and you saw your drug and you wanted to go out and see it, how would you go out there and see that data?
So we're actually working right now, and we have a volunteer from Facebook who's helping visualize our data and make it interactive. And so soon you'll be able to come in, look up your drug, look up a company, or look up any metric that you're interested in learning about and interact with it. See how much safety and efficacy information there is available on the drug, how much safety and efficacy information was disclosed about a drug. So if you're on a formulary and you want to know if you have all of the medical evidence you need to make your decisions, you can look that up. If you're a patient advocacy group and you recruit research subjects for clinical trials and you want to know if a particular company is transparent and contributes to generalizable knowledge and will honor the commitment of your participants and patients, you can look that company up. And if you're an investor and you want to know how transparent a company is, you'll be able to look that up. So that's forthcoming. And there are two other new things that will come out with subsequent scorecards that are worth mentioning. The 2015 rankings, so the rankings of all the drugs approved by 2015, will have a new standard. We will look at patient-level data sharing because the previous scorecards looked at summary results reporting and publication in a medical journal. But now we're creating the metrics with colleagues at Yale University and Stanford University on what does it mean to share patient-level data, right? Everyone's talking about it, but we don't actually know how to measure it. So we'll come out with the first set of measurable standards, and then we'll score the drugs and the companies on those metrics. And then we've been lucky enough to receive a very large grant from the Arnold Foundation for $3.6 million to make sure that we can keep up with all of the FDA approvals. So every time the FDA approves a new agent, we will score it for its clinical trial transparency, and then we will rank the entity along with the company sponsor on their transparency. And that means that we'll have to add all sized companies as well as biologics and devices slowly over time.
I told you you had a lot of work to do.
Yes, we do.
That's right. Jennifer, just a real pleasure. Please come back. See us anytime. We'd love you coming in.
Thanks, Mara.
Jennifer Miller is a professor at NYU Medical School and the founder and president of Bioethics International. More information is available on the web at bioethicsinternational.org. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment, Biotech Nation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.